seminary level theology course. This is a practical course in systematic theology. And I really think that the subject of ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church and its ins and outs, is a huge separate study. It's a subject that deserves its own series of studies because there is so much. It's such a huge field. So for those two reasons, I have opted to leave that entire section of study out of this particular systematic theology series. Having said that, I will mention that we do now have, for the sake of the recording, much as anything, we do now have Baldwin's book on baptism in our possession and ready to go for distribution. And in it, we were discussing, my wife and I were discussing yesterday, one of the reasons so many who even have already received the book might not recognize the value at first. Hopefully they will read it and then recognize, but the reason they might not is because the subject of baptism, it's Baldwin on baptism, which is, of course, a contracted title. That's not the full title. But the truth is that what he's dealing with really goes to the heart of our doctrine of sola scriptura. It goes to this fact of our drawing all our doctrine and practices from the scripture. And I know that our pedobaptist brethren say that and they tout that phrase, but when it comes to the subject of baptism, they go immediately, they leave the rails and go off into talking to me about tradition, the history of the church, the history of ecclesiology, etc., etc. And they leave the principle of sola scriptura. And Baldwin is driving home the point of obedience to the scriptures, and that alone. And so it touches then. It really is overlays everything we do, every practice, not just baptism, but close communion and every other practice that we have. The importance of taking the scriptures alone. So I said all that simply to say I'm not ignorant of the fact that I am leaving untouched in this systematic theology study. I'm leaving untouched ecclesiology, because of the reasons I gave you. Now today, concluding eschatology by talking about the eschatology of the earth. Because that really is, you might say, that's the end of the end. I mean, that really is the end in terms of this world's history. And there's a lot that will be unanswered. I will refer you again to our Confession of Faith, the 1689 Second London Confession of Faith. Frankly, all that it says about all that the Confession of Faith says about last things is all that I'm prepared to say dogmatically, because there's just so much that men seem to become dogmatic about, which, frankly, we just don't have a lot of revelation on it. And I think we're better. I mean, I'm not telling you not to frame your own opinions. I would encourage you to search the scriptures and satisfy your own heart with regards to the answer to any question. But in terms of teaching it or becoming dogmatic about it with other people, I think we should hold off of that, because I'm not prepared to defend from Scripture many things, and therefore I just not teach them. Gill said the effects, of course, the last thing will be Christ's coming. And the effects of Christ's coming and his personal appearance are many. For example, the resurrection of just, of which we have treated largely already, the burning of the world, which we have not, but you understand the scripture teaches that the world will be burned up. He will make new heavens and a new earth. All this is clearly defined not just in Revelation, but in other places. And then the making of new heavens and earth, and then the reign of Christ here with his saints for 1,000 years. Now, I am prepared to be dogmatic on that. I will not be dogmatic as to what comes before, what comes after, or how that all plays out. I'm pretty clear, and I've studied Gill again thoroughly on this. I'm pretty clear that the scriptures, not John Gill, but the scriptures teach a definite 1,000-year reign. So I'm prepared to say that and basically nothing more. But that he will come, he will reign with his people. There is a judgment to be had, and all of those things will be had in order. Now, first off, let me say to you that the earth and the heavens, I spoke of it, 1 Peter 3:10 and 12 through 13, the heavens and the earth will be burned up. Now, you talk about eschatology, talk about future things, talk about last events. The heavens and the earth will be burned up, and the scripture proof of that is huge. Isaiah 24, verses 1, 3, 4, 19, and 20 talks about this disillusion. Psalms 97, verse 3, 4, and 5 talks about a fire that goes before him that burns up the perdition of ungodly men. Isaiah 66, 15 and 16 says, behold, the Lord will come with fire, taking vengeance on the wicked, which is given in the New Testament, 2 Thessalonians 1, 7, and 2 Peter 3, 10, by fire and by the sword, and so on and on. The scriptures clearly speak to the fact that the earth will be burned up. Now, there is a controversy about this burning up and then creating new heavens and new earth. And of course, leave it to Gill. I won't go into it, but he goes into it extensively, that whether that means that the earth will be burned up into a somewhat of a molten state and then reconstructed, or whether it's burned literally out of existence and he starts again with nothing and creates a new heaven, new earth. Those are wonderful and interesting questions. We don't have answers for them. It is the scriptures are not very specific. The general consensus of most theologians is that the earth will be burned, meaning it will be purged and then reformed and reinstated in its paradise condition. And not that it is literally burned out of existence. That's the typical understanding of that. Then there will be a new heaven and a new earth. Again, the scriptures are very clear on that. 2 Peter 3:13, Isaiah 65:17, a new heaven and a new earth. The new heaven must be interpreted, Gill says, of the airy heavens, a new air in them. That is, it's not talking about the entire expanse of the universe, but the atmosphere, if you please, of the earth. The heavens will be set on fire. They'll be liquefied and dissolved. These are not the starry heavens, but the airy heavens only, so Gill says. You may differ with that if you please. They'll be purged, purified, and refined by fire and become a new air. Ezra interprets the new heavens in Isaiah 65:17 of a good air, a healthful air, such as the new heavens will have been purged by fire. It is clear of all noxious vapors and exhalations. It will be free from all unhealthy fogs, mist, and meteors, watery and fiery. Everything noxious, poisonous, dangerous will be removed. Everything. New heavens. And, of course, a new earth. It'll be new in every way. New as to its surface, new as to its functions, and new as to its occupants. A new heaven and a new earth. Who are the inhabitants of it? When God made the first earth, and which was made by him to be inhabited, by the way, I think that's a significant point we often miss over. God didn't create the earth, and then, like, on the last day, it was like an afterthought. Oh, wow, you know, this would be a great place to put an inhabitant. No, the earth was designed for habitation from the beginning. That was his purpose. And it was designed for that, made to be inhabited. There were at first but two whom he created to dwell upon it. And when it was destroyed by the flood and recovered from the deluge, there were but eight preserved to repeople it. So at one time, the whole earth only occupied by two people. Another time, only occupied by eight. But when the new heavens and new earth are formed, there will be now to stock them all at once. There will be new occupants. It may be asked, from whence will they be had, since the air will be cleared of devils and all wicked men burn up, so that there will not be a devil in the air nor a wicked man upon the earth? Then who shall inhabit it? Christ will bring with him the souls of all his saints, of all the chosen people that have been from the beginning of the world, whose bodies he will then raise and reunite them to their souls, and the living saints that will be found on the earth when he shall come will be changed and caught up in the air, where they will abide till the earth is fit for them, and then they will be let down, millions and millions of them, even the whole general assembly and church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven, and will fill the earth at once. Now, that's Gill's view. Okay. You may not share that view. Any part or all of that you may modify at will. But that's what Gill says. And when I become as studied and proficient in Hebrew and ancient writings and scripture exposition as he is, I will form a different opinion if I please. Till then, I'm going with his. And if he's wrong, we'll all be there to find it out. So that's fine. As to the millennial reign, I will make no other comment than what I have made, that there will be a literal. Now that I'm emphatic about, there is a literal earthly 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth with his people. No question about that. And then there is the final judgment. There is a final judgment of the wicked. The scripture is prolific with reference to this. Jude 14 and 15, 1 Samuel 2, 10, Psalm 53 and 4, Matthew 5, 21, 22, Acts 10, 42, 1 Peter 4, 9, 2 Peter 2, 9, and just on and on and on it goes. The scripture is prolific in pointing men to this final judgment. Now, you can detail it out as you please as far as time scale. You can draw you a chart and map it any way you want to. But the fact of it is immovable. And it is the fact of it that ought to occupy our mind and our efforts, our labors in the gospel. It is the fact of it. I don't care about the details of it as to time and how it fits in the scheme of eschatology. I'm not as concerned with that as I am with the fact of it, the reality of it. Luke brought a message, I don't know if it was this past New Year's or the one before that, brought a message on hell. And what a sober thing on a New Year's Day. What a sobering thing to be pointed to the reality of this final judgment. Just the fact of it is enough for me. It's enough for me to be occupied with. And that is the eschatology of, that is the eschatology of the earth. It will be final. New heavens, new earth, reign of Christ, and then final judgment when all the unsaved will be cast into the lake of fire. And Revelation says that death and hell will be put into this lake. This is an eternal lake of fire. Death and hell will be turned into that lake, along with every man that dies, man, woman, child, dies without Christ. So, that is the eschatology of the earth. And that will be the conclusion of eschatology, period. What remains after that is the one thing I wanted to be sure I remember to tell you about the eschatology of the believer in heaven. I've been reading a lot lately, just running across it. I wasn't looking for it, but it's just providentially in several of my different readings, I've been bumping into this. The fact that in heaven, notwithstanding Bugs Bunny and the cartoons, we're not going to float around on cloud playing harp. Our eternal occupation, there will be occupation. There will be employment. There will be things for us to do. We will be more like our Creator than ever we have been. And what is He? A Creator. It is in His being to create. And we will share that. I read a testimony last night. I finished the testimony of John Bryan's wife. And she lost a daughter at 5 years of age. And it was very hard. She reeled spiritually from that for quite a while. And she made a comment in writing her mother. She and her mother exchanged letters regularly. And her mother was clearly a great source of strength for her. Her mother was, as she faced the loss of this child. And one of her letters, she said to her mother that the child had often recently been just playing, and then she would just stop and ask her mother about what will we be doing in heaven. And her mother would try best she could to answer a five-year-old question of what will we be doing in heaven. It's a fair question. And she made every attempt as a mother to supply a good answer for that. And again, I was confronted with this fact that we're not going to be floating around on a cloud playing a harp. There's going to be things to do. We're going to be doing things in heaven. And I just wanted to say that to you, since we're closing the subject of eschatology and future things. It will be the occupation of the saints of God to praise the Lamb. We will be praising Him. But we will also be doing that which He has constructed for us to do. And I don't know what all that is, but I do know we will be like him. And he worked 6 days and rested one. And we will also be productively employed with all things that our God has structured for us. And that's a great comforting thought to me. Frankly, I don't feel any great draw to a heaven where I'm just floating around on a cloud. I'm very eager to know what it is God would let me do and let me see and learn, and to his glory I will be occupied. And that's exciting news to me. Okay, any questions or closing comments on the subject of eschatology?